Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 804.
I do want to also remind people that, speaking of comedy specials, Fun Comfortable is only going to be at the posting of this episode. You have one more day that Fun Comfortable is the 50-minute version is free. The one that aired on TV is free, uncensored, as a Nerdist podcast. And then we have to take it down per our agreement with Comedy Central. But it's available on iTunes and Google Play and Amazon.
So get all the versions.
Sony, but there's a deluxe version on iTunes that has the there's a Q&A afterwards, and it's an hour 15. So and if you like the podcast, go buy it because it's helpful. And if not, no worries. Thanks for listening. What do you got in the community corkboard?
I got two things right here: the podcast, The Film Fault, which is hosted by Bald Brian, who from the Adam Carolla Show, and Anderson, who from the late Love Line, which feels weird saying that.
It is weird.
I hate after 10 o'clock and it's not on. I just don't like it. They're doing a live show on May 22nd at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood. They'll be doing Flick Fessions, their top five list for the episode, and they're going to have exclusive giveaways and special guests. You can find tickets at filmvaultlive.weebly.com. And if you buy your tickets before May 13th, you get $5 off. And then also, two of my friends from high school, Aaron and Serge, started their own furniture company called Sons of Salvage up in the Bay Area. They create custom and amazing looking furniture, wall hangings, and more from reclaimed wood, and they do it all from hand. So they just opened up their shop in Petaluma. It's in the North Bay. So if you live in the Bay Area and you need some really cool looking handmade furniture, go check it out. You can find more info at facebook.com/Sons of Salvage.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Katie Levine. Now, this podcast is very special, Katie Levine. This is Jodie Foster. I have not seen a lot of long-form chats with Jodie Foster. I had no idea what to expect. And from the second I sat down, I'm telling you, and I will say this on record, this conversation with Jodie Foster is one of my top five favorite podcast experiences. And I don't want to raise expectations. So don't, whatever. But honestly, she was legitimately incredible.
She was amazing. She was so nice and so open and so smart. Oh my gosh, she's so smart.
Well, the smart's a given. I just didn't know if she was going to want to talk about anything. And honestly, one of my top five favorite podcast experiences of all time. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed chatting with her. She's promoting Money Monster, which is with George Clooney and Julia Roberts. It's in theaters this Friday, May 13th. Mm-hmm. So you should go see it because you should support Jodie Foster because she's fucking awesome and everything she does is amazing. And I swear to God, I feel like we're friends now. Maybe not. Maybe I've created that in my head, but
like hit it off. Like
even I feel like we really hit it off in such an amazing way.
Like you guys both had to leave and you're both just like, no, we want to continue talking together.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm very excited to present this podcast. So I'm going to not keep yammering at the top like I normally do. As you start to get older, folks, you just talk more. And now I explain for 10 minutes why people talk more when they get older. Listeners Podcast episode number 804 with Jodie Foster. Oh, and I do have to make one disclaimer, because a lot of people are going to be upset. Because sometimes when you have people on and they go, why didn't you ask about X? Mm-hmm. I did not bring up Contact, which hurts my stomach. When I left, I was like, I forgot to talk about Contact, because it is it's a movie that I love.
And it's one of my all-time favorites.
And it's a movie that stays with you, and it's a movie I still think about. And and it came out a year after Carl Sagan passed away. Yeah. And I really wanted to ask her, do you have a Carl Sagan story? But the conversation just flowed so nicely that I just didn't – I was so enthralled by her that I just didn't get to the Contact question. Yeah. So I apologize. You
we'll
don't
have her
need
back.
To,
Let's
you
just
don't
have her
need
back.
To tweet. We have to have her back. Jodie Foster, please come back on the podcast so I can ask you, did you have fun working on Contact?
I watched it the day after she did this podcast just because she was so great. And that's one of my all-time favorite movies.
It still holds up. The movie holds up.
I have to watch it.
So here's Jodie Foster on the Nerdist Podcast number 804. Katie, please, we'll roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I feel like my entire adult life has been to try to recreate my adolescent bedroom. That is essentially what everything is. I think it's kind of funny that
our generation has kind of had this ability to have our extended adolescent period. And I feel like our parents, like, they had to be adults at a certain age. But this is okay now.
This is totally okay.
It's good. It's really good.
Do you have a chill room? Is there, like, sort of a... like a room that you sort of made up with a lot of stuff that you like?
No, I'm a lie in my bed and stare at the ceiling person. And I don't collect anything, and I don't want anything. I'm one of those, I like to get rid of everything.
Yeah.
I would be the happiest I am is when I'm in an Oakwood hotel.
Really?
Yeah.
It's just as bare bones as possible.
Yeah, and nothing creative about it, or nothing that I have to think about, or, you know, polish, or... yeah, that would make me happy. I mean, I have a really nice house. Not that I don't.
It would be really funny if there's, like, you should just rent at the Oakwood apartment. It's like, yeah, Jodie Foster's at the Oakwood.
Nothing makes me happier.
Does that have to do with, did you grow up, like, in the Oakwoods?
No, but I grew up going on location.
And that's what that reminds you of?
I think so, yeah. It's that sort of rental furniture, and like, all I have to think about is my work. I don't have to think about anyone else. I don't have to worry about them. I don't have to feed them. I just can be in my little, you know, queen size bed with the IKEA stuff.
So then you must get stressed because when you're a performer, people send you things.
Yes.
You must get stuff and baskets and shit all the time. You're like, this is stressful. Why are you sending it? What do I do with this?
When I had a company, I feel like we spent at least 60% of the time at the company dealing with things people gave us and things we had to give them back in return in order to thank them for the things that they gave us. And it was just like, I feel like I employed people full time that did nothing but, you know, gift receiving and thanking, and, you know, it's like vicious, terrible, vicious cycle.
There is an economy of thanking. I want to thank you for your thanks. Here is a basket to thank you for that. Well, take these muffins.
I did. But then because Christmas was crazy. You know how it is in America with Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
It's not – other places don't believe that. They don't believe in, you know, you give gifts to your, you know, people who work for you or whatever, your friends. Or I mean, people in Europe are like, you do what? they have no idea what it's like. And I did a movie that was over Christmas. And I was freaking out. And finally I made a poem about why nobody was going to get any Christmas presents. And I, you know, did it nicely with good paper and stuff. And then it just became a tradition of coming up with new creative things that you make by hand that are about why no one's going to get any presents. And it just, became a tradition. Every year we come up with something new.
That's really funny. I mean, is there any kind of – is everyone pretty good-natured about it? They're like
– well, they stop giving you gifts.
Well, of course.
They really do. I mean, it took like a number of years because people were like, oh, she's just kidding.
Right.
And then eventually they're like, oh, no, she's not getting us anything. So I'm not getting her anything. And we all – you know, people just sort of agreed. And it started with just my friends, but then it kind of extended to the work. And people are relieved. They're just so relieved to – not have to.
To not have stuff.
Yeah. And the poem was always, or the song, sometimes it was songs. And depending on the year, like if it was the Katrina year, you know, it would be like a blues song.
Mm-hmm.
That was about why you're not getting a present. And it was, you know, it took some creativity. It's not like I put no thought into it.
Right.
And then it would be, you know, it would, then it sort of morphed into, we're not going to get you anything, but we're going to send you something that sort of has to do with the theme. And the theme was Katrina.
Right.
So, and it was a blues poem, so we're going to send you chicory coffee.
Oh,
you know, like we kind of went to that route. And then it started all over again.
It starts, and
we had to stop it again. Because then people were like, wait a minute, she got me coffee. Now I need to get her something.
Does that count? No, please, just keep the, don't, please. I mean, and it starts earlier and earlier. Like,
yeah.
Like, you start seeing Christmas decorations, like, right after Halloween.
That's right.
This is, like, the buying season. And you really do. You start looking at people in hierarchies. I'm like, okay, these are the $100 group. This is the $250 group. And this is – these people are the inner circle, so I got to go all out.
Oh, yeah. And I'm all, you know, computerized about it all. Everybody has lists and, you know, categories and
– so you're super organized.
Yeah, but I'm not kidding about the no present thing because it's oppressive. It's oppressive to have your entire month of December, which should be about, you know, decorating a tree or doing all that kind of stuff, doing nothing but going like, I gotta go to, you know, Macy's again.
You can't do it.
I can't do it.
You can't do it. Do you like you? So you don't like shopping either?
No.
Not at all.
No, I like shopping for stationery and for you know, hardware.
That's it. What kind of hardware?
Anything. I don't even use hardware. So
you're just like
that.
Being,
I don't mind.
You're just like being in like a Home Depot.
Yeah, no, but you know, you go up in the aisles and you go like, oh, I'm sure I need a new screwdriver, or I'm sure there's something. You know what I mean? It's that's a fun thing to shop for.
Well, you're a creator, so you do like to build. You do like to build things.
No,
like to,
I don't build things. Anything.
But you like to build stories.
I like to build stories that require no hardware whatsoever.
So when you're directing a movie and people come up to you and they go, what should we, how do we make, you just go, I don't know, you figure it out.
Well, yeah, well, no, I mean, that's the nice thing about being a director actually is that you're, it is your vision, which means you hopefully inspire a bunch of people that have expertise and you inspire them to, you know, bring the best of what they do to you. And then you say yes, no, maybe a little more blue, whatever.
Yeah. And do you feel like you always know those answers, or do you say them just to have an answer?
Oh, no. I mean, there's lots of things you don't know. And part of the process of preparing for a movie is figuring out what you want to say with your film and then refining the script and refining any kind of blueprint that you have, refining it so that it's, you know, ultimately all leads towards that meaning.
Yeah.
And that evolves over the course of the movie. You think it's about one thing when you start, and then by the end you realize that it was really about something else that's kind of deeper and more complicated. So it's an interesting combination of, it gets simpler, you keep simplifying, and then it also gets deeper and more complicated.
What do you learn about yourself? Because obviously you think it's about one thing, but then you start the process and you start expressing these subconscious ideas that you have. Yeah. Do you ever take a step back and go, huh, I guess that's what I was trying to work out?
Yeah, it's a personal, you know, that's the beauty of the personal movie, is that by the time you get to the end of the movie, by the time you get to the end of the process of it, whether it's the end of shooting or the end of editing, you've sort of uncovered some side of yourself that was unconscious at first and then now is there in all of its shameful neon.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting process, because I think you do kind of feel bad about yourself. It makes you feel bad about yourself, and then you have to embrace that and move through it. Yeah, the personal movie is an interesting thing. And this movie that I just made,
Money Monster,
you would say, is not a personal movie. And, you know, there's lots of bombs and guns and fast-paced things.
Stock market stuff
and big movie stars and all of that. So it is, you know, a general public movie that's taut and entertaining. But still, all the same personal movie things apply.
Yeah. You know? Do you feel more exposed as an actor or as a director? Like, when you put something out right there, what do you feel more exposed in?
Well, I think you're exposed in both things differently. You know, as an actor, you don't have any control of how somebody uses your body.
Right.
So it's just like you're just naked running down the street.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody can take a selfie of you. I guess that wouldn't be a selfie. That would be a youth.
An othery.
They can, you know, you're just out there. But as a director, the whole point is that you control the images, you control the sound, the score, the props, the actors. You're trying to create a full vision, and then you present it to people and say, this is what I meant to say about myself. So I think it's a way of being exposed and yet being as much in control of it as you possibly could.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I kind of wanted to just see, like, what was the first thing you ever did? And I went back, and it was like, you did a lot of sitcoms. You did like a lot of sitcoms when you were a kid.
Yes, because that's what kids do, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're short and blonde, you end up on some kind of three camera show. Yeah, I did everything. I did cartoons. I did three camera shows. I sang in dumb bands, like, you know, weird 1970s bands. And yeah, I did all sorts of
things. Did you like any of that when you were a kid, or was it just sort of like, oh, this is just what I do, I guess?
Yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking about it. It was just what I did. And I didn't hate it, because I think if I hated it, my mom would have intuited that and she would have said, you don't have to do it anymore.
Oh, that's cool.
I mean, there were parts of it that I hated. I hated, you know, washing off my makeup. I didn't like, or getting up at 4 a.m. and all that kind of stuff. But like any job, you know, there's parts of it you hate. But I think that I liked being a part of something that felt meaningful.
Yeah. So then it just sort of feels like when you're going through your resume, it's just like, oh, these really fun sitcom. And then taxi driver. And it's like, well, that is a fierce departure from everything else. So you was that a conscious decision? Were you auditioning for film at that point? Or was it just kind of an accidental, like, well, this is a job and, wow, it just turns out to be this?
No, I mean, I auditioned for everything. So, you know, you'd be stumped to find a movie in the 70s that had a kid in it that I hadn't auditioned for that I didn't know about. But there did come a certain point, maybe after I did Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was the first movie I did with Scorsese. I think I was coming to the end of the first real series that I had done. I did a series called Paper Moon.
Yep, based off the movie.
Right. And my mom kind of put her foot down and said, you will no longer do television and you will only do features.
Oh, wow.
I think she thought that was a good move. And so I did that. And then you know, the architecture of my career was really mostly about her. And I think the good news is that whatever vicarious thrill she got from my career was about me being somebody of substance and being respected. I think she wanted that for me, and maybe she wanted that for herself. And I think that was, you know, if you're going to have a vicarious thrill, that seems to be a good one.
Did you understand that at the time, or did you resent it in any way?
No, I didn't resent it. I just thought that's what I did. I thought that was my job, or that was my Olympic event.
Yeah.
Was telling her stories somehow, the stories that interested her. And then she was good at leaving me alone. We would get on set. She never ran lines with me. She never talked about the character with me. She would get on set and she would go directly to the trailer and read magazines and books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is kind of interesting. It almost seems like it's weird. It's almost like there's a hybrid. It's like sort of stage mommy, but not stage mommy at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. She's an interesting lady, a really interesting lady. I mean, very solitary and really liked being alone and all of that. But I think she liked being behind someone. And I think she liked watching me take flight. I guess like everybody does with their kids.
Sure.
You know, and she was just as supportive of my other brothers and sisters. I had a sister who did design and was an artist when she was younger. And my mom, you know, painstakingly took her to all those art things that my mom didn't care about. And, you know, she took my brother to his little peewee baseball and all that stuff that she didn't care about in the hopes that the kids would be fulfilled, you know.
Did you, when you saw Taxi Driver, did you have an understanding of what was happening in the movie?
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up in L.A. and sure. I grew up in Hollywood. I grew up, you know, 10 blocks from here, which is not a nice part of town.
No, and actually was really not nice.
No.
Like they've kind of glossed it up a little bit. It's like, oh, the El Capitan's really nice, and it's like Hollywood Highland. Oh, there's a Bath and Body Works. It's all nice, but
LA was a lot of reality, and it was great growing up here. I think, you know, my mom was really cool. I mean, we'd go eat, you know, Thai food and Filipino food and Korean food every day because we lived in this section of town.
Yeah,
and she was adventurous, and she took me to lots of movies that I probably shouldn't have gone to, you know, lots of R-rated movies when I was a kid because we were a movie family. And she'd take me to film festivals, and she'd take me to see European weird German films. And so I think I knew what movies were, and I certainly knew what Taxi Driver was. I'd seen Mean Streets a whole bunch of times.
Oh, nice.
yeah.
And, Mr. De Niro, I really liked you in Mean Streets. What?
Well, and I'd made more movies than they had at that point. You know,
that's
I'd
amazing.
Made a ton of films by that point. So I really did – I understood what it was to be a professional, and I wanted to be a part of something that seemed so big and important. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your kind of relationship on the set? I mean, like, did you have a relationship with anyone on the set? And like, did you hang out afterwards? Did you just talk to De Niro about stuff, or was it very like,
no,
I come in, do my work, and then I leave?
Yeah, I came, did my work, and then I left. I mean, they were grown-ups, and Robert De Niro was in his I Am Robert De Niro phase, so he was in his like I'm you know studying every role and I'm becoming the part and all of that. He was odd, really generous with me and really wanted to help me in some ways, you know, learn what improvisation was. And he sort of took me through the steps of that without me even realizing it. But I didn't want to hang out with any of those people.
You just wanted to go do the job.
Well, I was in New York City in the summer. I went to see tons of plays. I rode around in hansom cabs in Central Park. You skateboarded. You know, I did all that stuff that was thrilling for me to be in New York City. It was thrilling to do that. I remember all the plays I saw.
Oh, yeah? What was playing at the time?
It was Equus.
Uh-huh.
I saw that like three times with different actors. Pippin. It was Pippin, Chicago, I think. A Little Night Music, I think, was on at that time.
Do you like do you like doing theater?
Never liked doing theater.
No.
I did it at school a little bit, and then when I was in college, I did one play, and I was like, wow, I don't need to act in theater.
What is it about theater?
I think it's just that your one and only job is acting. And for me, it's not that that's the least interesting job, but the acting without the camera and without, you know, creating something complete that you then present to an audience, I guess I don't like the spontaneity.
Oh, interesting.
And that's the thing that everybody loves is the spontaneity. I love being an audience member and seeing theater. I love it. There's nothing like it. But I don't like how imperfect it is.
Right. And exactly. Also, it's to a degree, it's, you know, it's only controlled so far. Like, it's not an entirely controlled environment. Because you are forming an immediate relationship with the audience. It's
yeah,
right there.
And you know, they can look wherever they want. And that's a problem for me.
Oh,
I don't want them looking wherever they want. I want them looking exactly where I want them to look at exactly the right time.
So this whole VR revolution must be really frustrating. Like, stop looking around all over the place.
Yes.
I mean, everything, you know, everything seems like it needs to be in 360. And I kind of feel like, yeah, but there's a certain kind of storytelling that really needs to tell the people, like, this is where you should look right now.
Well, it's a really interesting time in movie making, and you know, it's a transition period right now, but technology has gone so much quicker and so much further than we could have ever thought, that in some ways the trickeries and the, you know, backflips of technology that we can do right now are wagging everything else.
Yeah.
You know, the kinds of new TVs that are out now, for example, this, you know, HDR revolution of TVs that are out that now, you know, people are starting to buy. And you're like, wait a minute, why are you buying that? I mean, do you know what that's going to look like? And for some movies, it's wonderful. It's wonderful for the eye, for the television eye to see things that the normal eye can't see. Or
yeah.
To have an experience that the normal eye doesn't experience. But is it painterly? And would that be good for a period movie? Is it good for everything? And should everything be run through that? Because now we're creating a technology that now is going to obliterate all the other technologies.
Right.
And then you won't be able to make a movie that looks like the human eye. Is that what we want to do? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, how much information can the human brain process? And there, and it's certainly like when stuff, when you see it HD and it's like, oh, look, they kind of made it HD this whole movie. You're like, well, that just looks like shit. Like, it wasn't supposed to look that way. Like, it kind of needs to be, yeah. You know,
well,
it needs to be a little fuzzy.
And you choose things for a reason. I mean, you choose, for example, you know, let's decide you decide to have a blue pallor and the whole film has kind of like a blue quality to it, a coldness to it, because it elicits a certain emotion because that's how you're telling the story. And the audience may not realize that they're feeling a certain way. Because of the various techniques that you've employed, the choices that you've made.
Yeah.
But the second you just use technology because you can, and you know, bigger, better, faster, deeper, more saturated, more contrasty is supposed to be better, it's not necessarily the intention of the filmmaker.
Right. You know?
But that's true of everything now. I mean, I think that's true of everything now. The cyborg experience and our relationship to it, you know, how we are intravenously, whether we like it or not, becoming more and more cyborg is really taking over everything, not just art, but it's taking over everything.
Well, sure, because I think there's this idea that more is better and progress is, like, quote-unquote, progress is always what you should strive for without really thinking, like, well, where are we going and what is this progressing to and how is this affecting our lives? I mean, to kind of really understand how certainly the internet, which I don't think we have fully evolved to process right. The wealth of information and the social media, everything's social media. What are the effects of that going to be in 20 years? I don't know.
Yeah,
I hope it nets positive.
It's a really interesting time. That's why I say it's a sort of an interesting transition period. And I'm not, I don't want to be an old fogey because I really I see the beauty that technology's brought to us, you know, in the arts and everywhere else and the ease and all that kind of stuff. So I do want to, you know, like gaming, for example, which is there's just such amazing artistry in gaming right now, probably more creative than anywhere else in the industry. So I'm not, you know, spitting on all of that stuff, but I just don't know where I fit in and where am I going to go. I mean, I don't know about you. You guys probably know what's happening in the world. Like, I hear at least 10 times a day somebody says to me, oh, yeah, how about that thing on blah, blah, blah? And I go, huh? What thing? Like, I never know anything. I never know what television show is happening. I don't know what people are wearing. I don't know what song. Everybody else somehow is ahead of me. And it's not because I'm doing all these fabulous things that are taking my time. I'm not doing anything.
You're just lying in bed staring at the ceiling.
Yeah. And I'm not like getting a lot done or, you know, solving nuclear fusion or something. I'm not doing anything. And I can't keep up. And is that okay? Like, I'm worried. Like, is that okay? Because it's not like I'm, you know, getting a Nobel Prize because I'm not on the internet.
But so you're not on the internet at all?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I do the regular things, but who can keep up? I mean,
no, it's impossible.
Yeah.
Well, I think most people, don't you just ask your kids, like, what do you do?
Well, I hand them my device. And I say, you do it. Yeah, it's pretty much what I do. I hand it over to somebody else.
I mean, it is a whole separate job almost to keep up with all that stuff. And even though I feel like, yeah, I do a lot of things and I host a show that is all about social media. And so I feel like I still feel like I don't know most of what someone will go, hey, did you see that? No, I didn't. Where did that? You know, so it is, I think it's just literally impossible right now. That would have to be your sole job.
Yeah, and it's really good for people that have fact minds that love to accumulate pieces of information. And I have like a – it's almost like I've had a disease that, you know, fried certain parts of my gray matter at birth or something because I can't retain – I don't retain facts. I don't know why.
It could be part of your clutter aversion.
I don't like – I'm not that into facts. I that's why I was bad on those tests. You know, they'd say, you know, how many horses did so-and-so? I'd be like, I don't know, and I don't care. I don't know. 1792. I have no idea. I don't retain it. I don't care. I'm not a fact person, but I'm an idea person. So yeah. I'll retain ideas. I'll retain people's faces. I'll remember casting on something from, you know, 40 years ago. But I don't have a lot of room for facts. So this is like the worst generation in the world for me.
Yeah, but you obviously – I mean, you went to Yale. I mean, you obviously –
Yeah, but I did. I wrote papers. I figured it out. I figured out my sophomore year. I was like, hey, if I never take a test class and I just take paper classes, then I'm going to get really good grades.
And it totally worked.
Yeah, I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote.
But people realized early on that you were super smart, and that was kind of interesting. That must have been kind of interesting. They're like, wow, an actor that speaks more than one language. I mean, this is crazy. You know, like everyone, I feel like pretty quickly when you were a teenager, they started making a big deal out of that. That was that odd or off-putting or?
It was nice, I think. It's nice to feel like people respect you, even though it's not really based in a lot of reality. I mean, not only did I not feel smarter than anybody I went to college with, I felt completely dumber than anyone I went to college with. Maybe everybody feels that way.
I think maybe most people do feel that way.
Yeah, I think they probably do. But I guess at the time it was unusual for an actor to, you know, go into academia. And it's unusual even now for an actor to be that interested in big concepts. You know, they're kind of moment by moment people, and because I wasn't born to be an actor, I think I just adapted to one. It's what's made my acting a little unusual.
But what made you go back? I mean, because everything. Oh, and by the way, I just want to tell you, I love Candleshoe. I don't know if you hear that a lot.
I don't.
I don't know if you care. Maybe you don't. But it's such a great. It's such a wonderful movie. Actually, the people on Twitter who knew you were coming on, they were like, ask her if she's going to make Candleshoe 2. And I'm like, she's probably not going to do that.
That would be funny if I did Candleshoe 2. Well, I'd play the Helen Hayes character.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yes. You could go back.
I could go back.
You could go back. I mean, you know, were those experiences fun for you or did they feel like work? Or did you have one that particularly felt like special to you?
Well, it was my whole life. I mean, it was my whole life. So I never stopped and went like, wow, how does this feel? Or I never considered it. I knew it was my job, but I also knew that it was everything that I'd ever known. I mean, I started at the time I was three, so I don't really have any memories
sure.
that before I started acting. It was just what I did. I start realizing it now. I see, you know, I'm trying to figure out, like, what do my kids do for the summer? And I just don't have any reference. Like, I don't know what kids are supposed to do.
Oh, you do a movie, right? Your kids are going to do a movie this summer?
Well, I did a movie every summer of my life. I never, you know, I was never on a team. I didn't go to summer camp. I didn't, you know, lay around in the house watching television and, you know, getting bored or go out with the neighborhood kids. Like, I didn't have that life. And I don't know what to do with I don't know what I'm supposed to do with them.
Maybe it is camp or maybe it is a trip or something.
Yeah, they do all that, but it seems a little lazy.
Right.
It all seems a little lazy compared to my childhood, I guess. It seems
well,
a little
lazy.
Well,
you did have an exceptional childhood. Your childhood was different than, I would say, almost everyone in the history of time. So that is kind of an interesting thing to think about, is if you were conditioned to do all these things and have this work ethic and have to do this, and you were an income earner from the time you were three.
Yeah.
But your kids, you know, maybe they're like, hey, can we just lie around?
Yeah, and pretty much that's what they do. They do a lot of lying around.
When I was your age, I went to the Academy Awards. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, and it was a lot of – I see the burden of it. I mean, I see that it's shaped my personalities in positive ways but also in negative ways too. You know, that's a lot of responsibility for a little kid, and it's a lot of worry and a lot of feeling like a lot of obligation, feeling like if I did it wrong, something bad would happen to the people I loved around me.
Sure.
You know, if I got fired, it was a big deal in my family.
Right.
Or if I didn't work, you know, I supported the family, so that was a big deal.
Yeah.
Or if I, you know, was messed up and left school and became a stripper, that would have impacted my family.
So. Absolutely. I mean, I found an old interview you did with Roger Ebert when you were like 16 or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it was... And I think it was the question of, well, you know, like young stars, like they go out and they go to parties. Like, I think it was right around Foxes or something.
It was talking
about, like, are you anything like these characters? Like, no, I just go home. Like, it's not – don't lead a crazy lifestyle. Was that by choice? Did none of that interest you, or was there strict parenting?
Yeah, it just was my personality. And I think my mom was – I don't know how strict she was. I mean, of all the kids, I never had a curfew. There really wasn't anything that I was ever told that I couldn't do, I think because I didn't care or I didn't want that, you know. And I liked my time alone. I liked reading and I liked movies. And I was really geared towards school.
Oh, wow. So. That's such an interesting – I mean, to go to school, to go to Yale and to major in literature and then to go, I think I'm going to go back and act again. Like, was it – did you just go, well, I don't know what else to do, or did you just miss the process of it?
Well, I worked the whole time I was in school, so I did five movies while I was at Yale.
And for some reason, I thought you like took a couple years off and went...
Because the movies weren't very successful, but no. I did. I made a lot of movies. And but I didn't think that I would work after 18. Everybody kept telling me your career will be over by the time you're 18. My mom kept saying that, and she'd say, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to be a doctor? You know, the inference was you definitely don't want to be an actor when you grow up because it's not going to be available to you.
Oh, that's crazy.
But that was true. I think that was true of pretty much every young actor, that by the time they were 18, their career was over. So I assumed I'd go to college and then I would, you know, maybe try and act a little bit just to sort of keep the income thing because I'd always done
sure.
it. And then it would just fizzle out and then I'd move on to whatever it was that I was going to do after. And that didn't really happen.
Was it did it happen accidentally or did you really, really did you feel defiant? Like, oh, well, maybe I will show you that I'm going to work past 18.
I think I was a little defiant. I remember when I graduated from college and I spent that, you know, first 6 months – no, sleeping till noon and not knowing what I was going to do with my life. I went out on auditions, a bunch of auditions, and I remember feeling like, wow, I see how dedicated actors are, and they're like, you know, I don't care. I just want to be in a Fruit of Loom commercial. That's fine by me. But I didn't feel that way. I felt like, wow, I've acted my entire life, and if I'm not going to work on really good scripts, then I'm not sure this is what I want to do with my life. I'm not sure that it's worth it to me because I'd already done it already. I'd done – taken all those steps. I'd done 1,000 junkets. I'd done – you know, I'd done all of it. So was I just going to do that for another 60 years and hope to, you know, get a couple commercials a year or something. So I kind of, you know, I got, took my GREs and thought I'd go to grad school and try to figure out what else I would do. And then, you know, I did The Accused, and that sort of changed everything.
That really did change it. I mean, did you did you understand that as you were making it? This is going to be a serious, important movie?
I don't know. I knew the role was kind of life-changing. I didn't know whether I didn't know whether the film was going to be successful or not. I didn't think I was very good in it.
Really?
And I was more convinced than ever that I needed to go to grad school. And so I just assumed my career was over then. That's when I thought was the end of my career, was The Accused.
But then after The Accused, then after the nomination, after all that happened, did you go, oh, maybe I'm not a good judge of my own stuff?
Yeah, it made me realize something. I think, well, I was only 25, however old I was, and I brought my own prejudices to it. You know, I think I was confused by the character because she was kind of offensive and mouthy and loud and annoying, and I'm not that way.
Right.
So I was sort of like, wow, she's irritating. I think everyone's going to hate this movie. And but I couldn't figure out how to play her any differently. So I was hard on myself. I kept thinking like, why can't I figure out how to play this character differently? And then I realized that it was, you know, that was the instinct that I had, and I had to stop thinking about it and just go with the instinct that I had, and that it was a good lesson for me.
To trust your instincts.
Yeah, yeah.
When all of the everything, you know, really took off, like really blew up after that, did that make you uncomfortable? Like, was it so much that it was kind of uncomfortable being under the scrutiny and the I mean, even though you had been when you were a kid, did it just feel familiar in not a good way?
Well, there's good parts and bad parts, and I kind of felt like that was my family business that I was raised in, and that I was, you know, I had the right mechanics to be able to pull it off, I guess. You know, like if you're an astronaut and you don't get nausea and you don't mind the zero G and you don't mind being alone, well, astronaut is a good job for you.
Right.
And I thought that, you know, being a successful actor and being in the public eye was kind of a good job for me because I had a system. And I had the system that I had had as a child, and, you know, I did my junkets, and I showed up on time, and I knew everybody's names, and I compartmentalized my life, and that somehow wouldn't affect me in any kind of adverse way. I figured, like, I had a handle on it. And to some extent, that's kind of true, but to another extent, it does impact on your life. And
absolutely.
You know, if you grow up a certain way, if you grow up in the wilderness – without any parents, you know, maybe you have a happy life, but it's a different life than you might have had.
You just described Nell.
Yes. But you know, you get these survival tools that get you through it. And then later on in life, you realize that the survival tools might be a little, might be because of trauma.
Sure. Oh, interesting. And is that something you've faced or thought about, or do you?
I do think about it, and I think about it, and it comes out in the movies I make. You know, I think that I think that's certainly a little Man Tate, you know, the Beaver, and certainly Money Monster. I mean, all three of those. There's a theme of the celebrity or all those people that have expectations of you, and you think of yourself as this just, you know, failed person. And that always happens. I mean, that's – how are you supposed to know who you are if you're constantly being put up on a pedestal or you're constantly being treated like somebody who's different? You know, it's hard to figure out what your own real identity is. In fact, I don't think you can figure it out there in the moment. I think you have to step outside of it for a second and realize, you know, what it's done to you in some ways.
I mean – this idea that, you know, being put up on a pedestal or this kind of one-dimensional representation of what people think you are, of course it has to screw with your identity because other people are telling you, oh, this is – you're in a box and we're going to put you here and this is you. And how do you even – when you – that's all you know. How do you even get around that?
Yeah. I mean, it's – well, hopefully you have good survival tools, which I think I did. My mom gave me good ones and I found some good ones on my own. But – yeah, I mean, you're merchandise, and you accept that. In fact, if you don't know any different, you just assume that's all you are. You just think you don't have any other worth besides your value as merchandise. And if people are still paying $20 for you, then you're a good Barbie.
Oh, man.
And if they're paying 50 cents for you and throwing you away in the trash, then obviously you're a bad Barbie. You know what I mean? So you learn that really, you know, that's a tough thing to figure out as a grown-up. And as a grown-up, you know, in order to be somewhat functioning, I think you have to figure out who you are and what your value is aside from the, you know, what people can extract from you.
And when did you start getting comfortable with – when did you start even figuring that out and get comfortable with it?
Well, that's the great thing about making movies. It's the great thing about writing books or painting paintings, I think, is you – it's self-expression, self-exploration, and you – it's not like you're just talking about yourself all the time. I think you start being attracted to things. You get attracted to ideas, and you think, why am I so – why can't I not get any sleep? I can't get any sleep. I can't stop thinking about that thing. And you don't understand why it's so relevant to you, but through the course of – you know, visualizing the film or making the film or injecting all of your own personal things onto it, suddenly you realize why that's important to you. And then you have an opportunity to talk about it and kind of switch your gears up.
Yeah. I mean, because I haven't actually – I don't know if I – you haven't really done a lot of long-form stuff at all, right?
Long-form, what is
it? Like long-form chats. Like,
oh, I don't, like what we're doing now?
Like exactly what we're doing right now. Have you done a lot of long-form stuff?
No, I don't. I've done, you know, NPR.
Yeah.
I've done interviews and things. And I'm just whoever it is that's in front of me. I have that bad habit where I just become whoever it is in front of me. So if I get somebody who asks me, you know, really serious, boring, depressing questions, I will get seriously boring and depressing. And if I have somebody who's just like, what is your favorite color? I can do that too.
Yeah.
Although that's the one I like the least. But if you have, you know, if you have a dialogue and with somebody that can kind of shoot back and forth, then I think you get into that.
Those are the adaptive skills. Yeah. I mean, that's so fascinating to hear that, because it's almost like a government program. Like, that's what you were trained to do, is be dropped into any situation and sort of be a chameleon in that situation and express whatever that environment.
Yeah, it's a little La Femme Nikita kind of thing.
It kind of is.
Yes, and that's your, you know, that is your survival tool. And some people are really, you know, it's why there's a lot of 18-year-olds that are film actors that, you know, end up dead in a hotel room or end up, you know, messed up. I mean, because children should not have to live that kind of life. I mean, they shouldn't have to. It's a weird Femme Nikita thing to have to do.
Yeah.
But I do feel like somehow I got given the tools to be able to be fairly well adjusted about it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, or at least be able to understand how to express it through art or something that allowed you to kind of deal with it rather than just imploding.
Yeah, rather than just imploding. Exactly.
I mean, you're
right.
You do have those days where you're like, well, I'm imploding today and everything's gone to shit.
Yeah, and there are things that shouldn't drive me crazy and that I should be able to handle that I can't handle at all because I didn't grow up like a regular person, you know, like a regular kid. I mean, there are things I just can't deal with.
Like what? Like what's something that just sends you into a complete tailspin?
I have a really hard time with my whole what you're going to wear and my whole physical appearance thing.
Right.
So I've learned – because it makes me so stressed out and makes me feel bad about myself. Like, I can't, you know, if I had a uniform, like if I was a Sikh, I would be really happy.
Because
somebody would say, okay, you just wear white. If you're a white Sikh, you just wear white. I wouldn't want to be a white Sikh. I'd want to be like a navy blue Sikh. But if they, right? You don't want to be, I don't look good in white. But if they just said to you, that's it, you can't, you have no other choice and all you can wear is navy blue. You can't, the car is navy blue, you know.
The shirt you're wearing is navy blue.
That's true.
Yeah.
Then I would be okay because I wouldn't have to go, how will I appear to them? Would it be better if I wore beige, or would it be better if I did a 3/4 skirt? Like all that stuff to me is paralyzing. I start breaking out and feeling like I don't have the answers to any of these questions. It all feels very arbitrary and it feels like I'm being judged on something that I'm not even good at.
Right.
So I just start flipping out. So I've learned as an adaptive skill, I've learned to get people to buy me outfits for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I request that. I'll be like, I need underwear, or I really need T-shirts.
What if they're like, well, by your rule, I can't give you a present, but here's a poem. Or you're like, no, I need a thing.
I need, damn it. Or I've learned that if I go on a press tour, for example, I have a really person who loves, who's great, loves to shop and is amazing and has great taste and who knows me and knows what fits me and is like, okay, where I'm going to bring over 10 things and we're going to see, you know, then you're going to wear this. And then she puts it in a hanger and then one of it says Monday. And literally the socks, the underwear, the bra, the everything. Like, I don't have to think about it. And then there's a little picture attached to it as well that is me in that thing. So I can't mess up. And then I don't have any anxiety.
It's just – everything is just that, like, A to B to C to laid out, so you don't have to
– Right.
That's really – there is a consistency that is really – that I really like, which is – You, it seems like your survival skill is just to get rid of any clutter, to have the simplest point from A to B, to unload emotionally and also in the physical universe, just anything that gets, that's cloudy.
Yeah.
Anything. It's just get it out of the way and let's just focus on the task at hand.
Yeah.
And in a business that is mostly about bullshit and clutter, that is an interesting dichotomy to have to live.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think that's why I've been able to get stuff done. I get a lot done. I mean, I can get things done because I know how to, you know, extricate all the shit from my ears. I can throw it all away and not listen. If there's a fire engine outside, I just don't pay attention.
Yeah, yeah, that's I mean, in some cases, yes, I can understand, like, okay, you may not know the TV shows and you may not have like a wall full of toys like I have here, but but you are more likely to get shit done in an efficient manner.
Yeah, and then I can choose what my joyful, you know, mindless activities are.
Yeah.
And I have those. And I can choose what they are. And then I can completely focus 100% on that, whether it's like I like football, for example. And I like Sunday football. And football and sports are the dumbest things in the world because they amount to nothing. At the end of the day, you have nothing to hold in your hand. You have like – they're just – A useless use of your time. But I really need that. And by the time I get to Sunday, I really need some kind of useless piece of time to completely and totally focus on.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I would tell you, and I'm not a sports person, but I will tell you I do understand it's not useless because it is, you know, I think the most important thing that people have is a community. Like,
right.
We're always constantly trying to find communities, and they're not always the best communities, but
right.
People just need to sort into communities because we need to feel connected to something. And there is a shared communal experience. You're watching a thing.
Yep.
You're shutting the world out. You're connected to an experience.
You're
that
painting
all
people, your face.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yes, you are. You're painting your face.
You're painting your face. You're writing John 3:16 on your chest, and you're getting drunk. But there is a shared, you know, kind of a human experience. So I really do understand that. And also, you know, finding ways to is that your favorite way to kind of distract your brain?
I really like skiing.
Oh, nice.
I really like to ski. And I think it's, you know, I mean, you know, nature, all of that. But I like the idea that if you don't pay attention, you're going to die.
Yeah.
That if you don't, you know, notice that tree and notice your feet and then somehow have all of that noticing and all of that concentration, you kind of morph into something that's just feelings, like dance, you know, that I like.
And you're in the moment. It's you're experiencing.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, the government, or if you think about people's birthdays, or you know what is going to happen to my son's feet if he doesn't wear his orthotics. If any of those responsibilities or fear comes into play, you will die. So you can't bring them in. Can't bring them in.
Do you express that to your kids where you're like, okay, listen, mommy's very methodical. You don't necessarily have to do all that stuff, but it is helpful in some ways. Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, I did a lot for them as children. I laid out their clothes and I, you know, I tied their shoes and I put their vitamins out. I did all that kind of stuff. I chopped all the wood and then I reached a certain point and I realized like, wow, they don't know how to chop wood. Like they don't know how to do anything. And like we used to have these plates. They were really cute. They had little French words on them and they had little compartments. And let's just say it was a zoo plate. Then it would say, you know, giraffe, monkey, you know, all that kind of stuff. But in each one of the compartments, you could put a different type of food. So you could put a fruit, you could put a rice, you could put meat, and you could put, you know, a vegetable. And there was probably one more compartment left. My kids got – they were like, wait, where's my fruit? They got to the point where they could only – they were like – they expected for there to be – 5 or 6 food groups at every time and for them to be in these little compartments. And I realized that I'm doing a terrible disservice. Like they should have some self – they have to start learning some kind of self-reliance and not think that somehow there's always going to be 5 food groups put in front of you.
You know, you didn't put the picture of my outfit, so I don't know.
Exactly.
What am I supposed to wear?
So now they have – you know, they're much more independent now.
Oh, that's cool though. Yeah. It's good. And it's also probably – you know, from what I understand about parenting, there's a lot of like you might want to over control, but you do have to relinquish some control to a point where it's probably a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, and now it's fun because now they're older and they're, you know, even though they're still my children, they're really like friends. So we'll go to movies together, or I say, you know, what time are you coming over, or you know, when is your girlfriend coming for dinner, and it's sort of it's like living with friends.
Oh, that's really nice. That's really nice. Yeah. So. After the accused, and then from then on, did you feel like you felt a tectonic shift in your career at that point? I imagine
I've had a lot of tectonic shifts. That was one. I mean, there have been a variety of them in my life where that have been big light bulb revelations about acting or about movies or about what I wanted to be or what I never wanted to do again. The accused was, I think it was committing to being an actor. And I'm not sure that I had consciously ever really 100% done that before. I had acted, of course, and I had, but I'm not sure. I just had never really committed to what an actor was, and that was the first experience for that.
Well, also, you know, did you have a movie like that before that had such a tremendous social impact? I mean, just you know, it was certainly a topic, and the way that it was presented was just something that wasn't really talked about in our culture, you know? And so, you know, representing this woman who was a victim of a horrible thing and then actually helped potentially other women speak up or fight back or something. I mean, did you feel the social impact of that?
Yeah, I guess I people wanted me to feel the social impact of that. And I found that problematic. Because I felt like I just wanted to make movies, and that's really what I was. If I was ever an expert at something, it was making movies
that's
and
what you
creating
knew.
Characters. And I didn't want to start getting off into some tangent where now I thought I knew how to be a doctor because I played one on TV.
Right.
And I was really careful about that. You know, I had had an experience that was profound for me, which was playing a rape victim, but I wasn't a rape victim,
right?
And I couldn't really speak as if I was one, and I didn't want to be put in. I don't like the spokesman thing, and I know a lot of people get it, and they're better at that than I am. But it's just not my personality. I'm not good at being a spokesman. All I know how to do is make movies,
right?
And speak French.
And you can make movies in French too. Movies in French.
That's true.
I mean, it's with Silence of the Lambs came along. Was that you must have sensed that was going to be a tectonic shift?
Well, while we were making the movie, I think we were excited about it, but I didn't really realize what that was going to be. No, I didn't realize where it was headed. I don't think you ever really do. I think hopefully you're just saying like, you know, how can I do justice to this character and how can I take this story from beginning to end? I think anytime you get cynical and start thinking like, ooh, the audience is going to love this or, you know, the audience is going to laugh here, you just fall flat on your face and make terrible turds. I think recipe for disaster, I think, anticipating audience's reaction and, you know, looking for result. It's just such a bad idea in filmmaking.
Yeah. Not a lot of big laughs in Silence of the Lambs.
Not too many
big laughs.
We had a lot while we were shooting, though. It was a fun set.
Oh, I can imagine. I bet it was amazing. I mean, just that group, and particularly – Do you find that when you're on a kind of heavy subject matter, there is more comedy on the set because people are just trying to process?
Sometimes that's true. It all comes from the director, you know, and the director is the person who sets the tone. A director is the person who, you know, everybody is sort of tiptoeing around figuring out how do they want it. You know, do they want the set to be light? Do they want it to be completely quiet? Do they want other people to have influence and to have opinions, or do they want it just to be completely shut out? And you spend the first week of shooting, or at least rehearsals anyway, figuring out who the director is and what they want. And then the set reflects that persona.
Yeah, because what you were talking about before, when you start getting result-oriented as opposed to process-oriented, that's where you kind of start to get fucked a little bit because mm-hmm. you cannot direct what's going to happen. So I think it's good for people to hear. It's good for creative people to hear. Like, yeah, even when we were making Silence of the Lambs, no one was like high-fiving, like, oh, boy, we're going to...
No, God, not at all. I mean, it was a nice set. I mean, Jonathan Demme is just a lovely man, and he's happy and joyful. He's just like a great parent. He's excited for you. He's that guy clapping on the sidelines on your soccer team when you're a kid. And he's very decisive, but he's just a lovely person. So the set was very warm. He has, you know, Aloha Shirt Fridays, and there's always a lot of music around, and there's a lot of musicians that come visit the set, and there's always somebody from his life or a member of his family that's in a scene with you, because all the extras are the technicians on the movie. Like, there's always someone that's a friend of his that's in the scene with you. And I think that his point of view as a filmmaker has always been goodness. You know, he always makes films from the good person's perspective. And bringing that to Silence of the Lambs was really the key to the film. Just that he really related to Clarice and to her leadership, you know, as a good person, a good, solid person who wanted to save women, instead of making the horror movie about the, you know, gross guy that chops people up and eats them.
Right. Because, there is a version of that movie where, you know, Anthony Hopkins' performance just eats up everyone. And it's like, well, that's all you see. But that didn't, you know, like, you still managed to find this really strong character to kind of come to his level. So was there a lot of rehearsal before you did that? Or did you just magically have chemistry with him?
Yeah, no rehearsal at all. In fact, we only met once for a read-through in New York City. He was busy doing another movie. So he came in for a read-through. And I don't know what happened. I got a phone call. I went to the bathroom. And by the time I came back, everybody was seated at the table already, and I hadn't met him. So I sat down, I shook hands with him, and then we did the role together. And I was so scared after the read-through, because he was so weird and scary, that I never talked to him really again. And when he finally came to set to do his 20 days of shooting, or however long it was, they bolted him in behind those jail walls. And because the scenes were so long, he'd spend one day bolted in on his side. And then the next day, with the camera would be facing the other direction, it would sort of be looking at me. So we kind of never were – it felt like we weren't in the same room together in a way. We were acting together, but we never really talked to each other.
Oh, wow.
And then that just became this weird self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, we never talked at all in the film. I just got more and more scared of him. And the last day of shooting – we finally had lunch together, and I was eating tuna fish sandwich. I remember that part. And he said, I was scared of you. I said, I was scared of you. And he threw his arms around me, and then, you know, it was all good from then on.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, when you work on something, is it sort of like when you move on, do you lose touch with people? Do you still keep in touch with people, or is it?
It's a weird thing being an actor. You definitely lose touch with everyone.
Sure.
And technicians all come together, right? If you're a camera department, usually you've worked together before. So the first AC, the second AC, the third AC, and the camera operator and the DP have all worked together. So they come as a department. And this is true of all the different departments, whether it's sound or, you know, lights or whatever. But as actors, you come in, you work with these people, and then you kind of never see them again. And when I was a kid, that was really traumatic, because I'd be on a set for a month or 2 months or 3 months, or be on a television show for longer. And then the show would get canceled, or the movie would be over, and I was 8 or 8 years old.
Which feels like forever.
Yeah. And then I never saw them again.
Oh, wow.
And so the first week was, you know, devastating. I was devastated not seeing these people every single day. If you live that way your whole life, then as time goes on, you get more and more used to it. And it's something you sort of accept. With actors, I I can never keep up friendships with actors. I just, they're always flying somewhere. They're always doing something. Actors sometimes are flaky.
Yeah.
And
sometimes
they're a little, they can be a little me first.
Sure.
It's like, oh, I'm, no, I've got to be in Palm Springs. Sorry, me first. So I never keep up with any of the actors that I've ever worked with. Very, very few. And we kind of shake hands at the end of the movie and go like, you're so fantastic and we've gotten so close. This has been such an intimate relationship and I'll probably never see you.
But there is something that – there's something kind of special about that. There was a moment in time that, yeah, that you had that you don't have to necessarily recreate because you got to go on and do, yeah, a new thing.
Yeah. And you kind of accept that. And there have been movies like that. I mean, this movie Carnage I did where there were just four of us. That was it. Just four of us in a room and one room the whole movie. And I feel like I got closer to those actors than I ever have, you know, ever. And we've never been able to connect again.
Is there a movie that in particular that maybe isn't so obvious that's really personal and special to you?
Well, there's, you know, they all are for their,
sure,
for their own reasons. But
which one did you feel the most? Oh, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I mean, I'd say The Brave One in a weird way. I think The Brave One was a really kind of a turning point for me. I felt it was a special movie for me. And there's something about this very solitary character who was discovering a side of herself that was kind of ugly but also super exciting and beautiful. And because the film was filmed at night and I was in New York City all by myself – and I spent a lot of time just like with my headphones on, walking in New York City. You do kind of – it's not that you become the character. That you definitely don't become the character. But you get obsessed with something. And then that's all you think about. And that's all you do. So you're pretty much obsessively inside one person.
Right.
And it was very life-changing, that movie, for me.
And had you not felt that before? I mean, it kind of seems like you're good at, do this and then kind of move on, do this, kind of move on.
Yeah, I guess that was the hardest movie for me to walk away from. It was just the hardest one to sort of shed in a way. I kept going like, but wait, that was beautiful and now I'm here, but I want to be back there. You know?
Oh, wow. Yeah, especially that far into your career that you could still have that experience.
Yeah.
And not be like, acting is acting.
Yeah, it made me – I realized a lot of things. I think I realized that I was sleeping a lot in my own life, and I just mean that metaphorically. I feel like I was a little bit asleep,
yeah,
so that when I did The Brave One, I was suddenly awake and – that I didn't want to go back to sleep again. So it made me change my life a little bit, and I started working more.
Do you have you acted in anything in the – I looked at your IMDb page, and it said, yeah, like 2013 was the last, yeah, acty thing.
Yeah, I haven't acted in anything.
Do you not want – obviously, you could if you wanted to. Just haven't seen anything?
I really want to focus on directing. I will act again. Of course I will. I mean, I've always acted. I'm sure I will act again.
Yeah.
I don't know what it'll be, and hopefully it'll be something that isn't what I already have done 100,000 times, which is hard to do when you've made so many movies. It's, you know, you can repeat yourself easily because people are always offering you the same parts that they offered you before.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, that's also – how do you – you know, as someone who's definitely – keep breaking. I mean, I think the same year you did Taxi Driver, you did Bugsy Malone, right?
Yeah.
Those must have been right on top of each other.
One right after the other.
Could not have been more disparate,
right,
experiences. Yeah. And of course, you know, I was the writer. I fucking loved that movie. It's like,
which one, Bugsy Malone?
Bugsy Malone, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think as a 6-year-old Taxi Driver was really in my wheelhouse, but you know, the Pie Guns and the, yeah, Paul Williams sound. I listened to that soundtrack 100,000 times.
Yeah, the pencil-thin mustaches. It was just great. So creative, so amazing. Alan Parker, he was so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked to do different things as an actor, and I know that there's something that I'm known for. And
what do you think that is?
That I'm drawn to and that I'm known for because I choose the parts.
Sure.
I play solitary, dramatic characters, you know, that go through something. I guess they go through something and find their heroism in some ways through trauma.
Sure. And so what is the type of a role that you would want to do? Have you ever just thought about, like, I just want to do a dumb comedy. I just want to, like, do a ridiculous comedy.
Comedy doesn't have the lure for me that it does for a lot of other people because, you know, comedy's not easy. Comedy's not fun to do comedies. To try to engineer having that energy over and over and over again, it just doesn't come naturally to me. I mean, I can do it, but I don't love it the way a lot of people do. I also, when I go to pick out a DVD, I don't go for comedy.
Right.
I'd rather see a drama. It just feels like a I don't know. It feels so too insubstantial.
Yeah.
But I would like to. I would like to be in a movie where I had to learn to do something really hard. So, you know, throw a javelin.
Sure.
Or play the violin, or speak Portuguese, or be a contortionist, or something that required big, like, physical, huge commitment. And I would do that for, you know, 4 months before shooting, and then I would shoot.
You know, you could just learn the violin.
That's true. I could do that. But then I won't have the discipline because –
You wouldn't have the discipline
because
it's
I'd be
all
like, oh, this is
work.
Hard. Yeah. I'm not doing this.
Ugh, there's no reason to do this. I don't have to do this. Now there's a violin in my house, and I just take it out. Just get rid of it.
Exactly.
Because we're such in an interesting time where, you know, film and television are kind of doing this. And so, you know, has anyone approached and be like, hey, maybe you should be on True Detective Season 3? You know, like it's like with some sort of mini television cinematic event.
Yeah, I get that a little bit. And I would definitely do it if it was the right thing. If it was something that was different than what I'd already played before.
Sure.
Something that was a crazy, wonderful stretch. That would be great. I love directing TV. I like serving the creator and serving the writer. You know, it's different than directing a feature. When you direct a feature, you really are the vision of the film. And
yeah.
In television, you're serving someone else. But I like that. I like being able to go from, you know, a thriller to something like House of Cards to something like Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
It's really fun for me to go back and forth between two totally different mediums.
I meant as an actor going on and doing like a mini event. I mean, because I know you've directed a bunch of.
Yeah, I would do it as an actor if I found the right thing, but I haven't really found the right thing.
Your first directing credit I saw was Tales from the Dark Side.
Well,
is that true?
It's true, but it's really it was a co-directing credit with
okay.
my good friend Bob Balaban, who
oh yeah of
is
course.
In the DGA,
of course,
and at the time. He wanted to direct this Tales from the Dark Side, but he couldn't because he was DGA. So he had to find some unsuspecting person who wasn't DGA who would be a co-director with him. And he said, you know, it should be somebody who really wants to direct and who will be able to learn from the experience. So he called me up and said, do you want to co-direct with me? You'll be from the beginning to the end of the process, and you'll be in editing, and you'll be in casting, and, you know, you can do all that with me. And I did.
Was
but
it fun?
It's really his show.
It is his show.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you did get credit for it.
I did. And then years later, I brought him in to act in Little Man Tate when I did my first movie as a director, you know, to sort of pay him back.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's really nice. I know you wrote your thesis on Toni Morrison. Is that
yes,
correct? Did
yes.
you ever get a chance to be friends with her?
I don't mean like Facebook friends.
No, like real friends.
I did interview her for the thesis, and it was amazing. It was an amazing experience.
Were you nervous?
I was so nervous. I arrived. I had to drive to Nyack, and I was in Connecticut, and I had to drive to Nyack, and I was like, I think I arrived like 2 hours early. So I just, you know, parked my car outside on the river and, you know, waited to meet Toni.
Now that must have been a unique experience because as someone who was so good at inhabiting other situations and now all of a sudden you kind of have to be yourself as a student just talking to another human being as Jodie Foster and Toni Morrison as Toni Morrison. That must have felt challenging.
It just felt great. I mean, it felt great. The years that I spent I'm kind of a head first person, meaning I'm not an emotions first person. I'm really a head first person. And I think I'm most comfortable when I'm processing things through my brain.
Yeah.
So college was sort of exactly up my alley. And literary criticism, which is what I was doing, you know, was really – that's kind of how I think.
And did any of that experience inform like how you work as a director or how you work as a performer? Like what were you able to extrapolate from that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, everything that you do anyways between the ages of 18 and 21 is somehow going to haunt you in your life. You're going to see all the shades of that come into your life. But, you know, I learned to read at college. I learned how to read a text and to look at it in a more meaningful way, to look at things deeper and to – organize my thoughts in the best way to communicate it to other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the most amazing university and it was really an amazing – I just can't believe that I went there. It's so great.
And throughout that time and then everything that followed afterwards, I mean, being able to, because I read something that said, it says, I looked at your Wikipedia page real fast and it says, Jodie Foster private life. Jodie basically says, Jodie Foster doesn't really like talk about her private life because she was so exposed as a child. And so she's very, very, very private.
Mm-hmm.
You feel, how have you managed to maintain a level of privacy? And how does that get in the way when you just want to do the work, but people want to talk about your clothes or your personal life or other, you know, some weird things have happened around you. So how do you process that?
Yeah, it's, you figure it out. And it's not my personality to be very public. It's not my personality. In the same way, it's not really I'm sure that if I hadn't grown up as an actor, as a child actor, I'm sure I wouldn't have been an actor. I can't imagine. I don't want to dance on the table and go like, look at me, or, you know, do imitations. And it's just not my personality. And it's not my personality to want the world to gaze at me and to tell them everything about me, to allow strangers, total strangers, millions of strangers into my most personal thoughts. It's not my personality.
And so are you able to kind of have, I would assume you are, it seems like you are, to have that piece of yourself that's just for you or the people closest to you, and then kind of knowing how to go into the mode that is like, oh, this is sort of public Jodie, but there's also private Jodie, and that's...
I think so. And I think you become, for lack of a better word, kind of dissociative. You learn to, just like a multiple personality person, you learn to have a public public person and a private person, and you become incredibly compartmentalized.
Oh wow.
And so that's the bad flip side of, you know, how to survive and be fairly well adjusted as a celebrity actor, as a young person. I mean, I had to learn to dissociate myself, you know. I had to learn to have connections and then walk away. And I had to learn to draw lines, to have boundaries about how far I wanted people in my life. And my mom was smart. She had been a publicist when she was young, and for a junior publicist with people like Marilyn Monroe, and she worked at a very important firm. And she had seen those lessons, so she was careful. I mean, she gave me all those lessons. You know, she'd say, fools. Faces are found in public places. She would say to me, she'd be like, don't get your picture taken. There's no reason to have your picture taken. You have your picture taken because you're promoting a movie, but there's no reason to have your picture taken for any other reason. You don't need to promote your life. You just promote your movie.
Oh my God. She was
very clear about trying to create boundaries that would allow me to be a healthy person when I grew up. I mean, that was her goal, was that I would be a healthy person psychologically.
She really almost was preparing you for what happens now. I mean, just, you know, growing up now, I don't even know how you could tell someone that. Like, it wouldn't even process. What do you mean? So just only kind of post on Instagram? No, never.
Never. Yes.
Never.
Yes. And some of that was fear, you know? I mean, some of that was some really healthy fear. And she gave me a whole bunch of fear about lots of things. And as you get older, you learn, like, oh, wow, maybe I shouldn't be so fearful. You know, maybe I should, you know, rebel against my mother now that I'm 55 years old. And
but you always feel the same inside. You always feel like the same. Like, you always, I think there's it's somewhere between like 13 and 17. I feel like where your identity starts being formed, maybe it's around puberty. I don't know. But you always kind of feel like that person, don't you think? You still feel like that person?
Yeah. I think I do. I mean, I think I do. I feel like I used to be way smarter, though. I feel like I'm the dumber version of myself.
That sounds like wisdom. I think people, when they get wise, they start to go, oh, I don't know everything. Yeah. I think it's dumber to go like, I totally got this, you know?
Yeah, I guess. I just felt so much smarter when I was younger. But my mom definitely prepared me. And some of that were good tools, and some of that were tools that I had to learn to get rid of. I feel like the beaver, that's sort of the story of the beaver.
Right.
It, you know, metaphorically is, or as an allegory, where you put on this beaver puppet on your hand because it allows you to be free and to express yourself and to connect with people and to be the person that you want to be. And you live with that for a long time, and then suddenly the beaver puppet is – you can't get it off your arm and it's trying to kill you. So you have to kill that. You have to get rid of it. I mean, you have to kill the thing that's been attached to you. That's allowed you to survive intact all these years. The reason you didn't kill yourself was because you had this thing attached to your arm, and now you got to cut it off.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
And it's painful. It is painful to have to suddenly go like, wow, I have to live differently. I have to look at things differently, and I have to not use the same survival tools that I used before. I mean, you know, my mom, I always felt like my mom's like the safest answer is no.
Right.
So if anybody says, do you want to go out to dinner? You go, no. do you want to try something new? No, that's okay. Do you want to, like that? I was given that mantra of, you know, no is the safest answer. And part of my adult life was learning to say yes a bit more, you know, learning to make a bigger fool of myself and to make mistakes. And
learn how to trust. Like, how do you've been really taught to trust people? Like,
well, you shouldn't trust people, honestly. You definitely don't go that far. Don't go crazy.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know, some very revolutionary ideas. I apologize. I went way out on a limb there. I admittedly was wrong. Everyone's out to get you. But particularly at that time, you know, especially in the 80s, it must have been such a crazy time for you with.
The 80s was nuts. I mean, the 80s in Los Angeles was crazy, and the 80s being in college was crazy, and there was, you know, plenty to be afraid of. The good news, you know, including, you know, the AIDS epidemic, by the way.
Right.
But you can't think of anything more fearful than that. But the good news is they hadn't invented those big, long lenses yet, or they had invented them, but not everybody was buying them.
Right.
So they didn't have you could kind of organize your life so that you could explore and be free and feel like you were living in the world as a real person. If I was a child, if I was a 18-year-old actor, you know, biggest actor in the world, you know, Jennifer Lawrence or whatever, I mean, my life would be very different now than it was when I was 18.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not – I don't – I feel like that is a crazy thing to survive. Like, how do you survive that? Because it just – everything's so much about getting clicks and traffic. It's like, oh, let's build this person up. Now let's tear them down. Yeah, but won't that hurt their fit? Yeah, fuck it. Who cares? You know, like we're getting clicks. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, how do we pick up the pieces and kind of deal with what our culture is wreaking on our I don't mean the negative parts of our egos, but I mean like our ego, like ourselves, our perceptions of ourselves.
Well, it's going to change our flora and fauna as a species. I mean, it already has. My kids' generations, they're just not so sensitive. You know, they're like, why? Who cares if everybody sees my picture? Why do I care? Why do I care? I mean, what, am I Maasai? Are they going to steal my soul? Like, why is that such a big deal to you? They may not, this new generation just may not understand what the big deal is because they've, you know, the evolution has changed them a bit. And they don't know what the beauty of privacy was because they've never experienced it.
Are you solitary to the point where sometimes you even have to say, like, either in your relationship or to your kids, like, I just need everyone to go away for a minute and I just need to be alone.
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, I have a problem. I have like a dichotomy problem, which is I need to communicate and I need to connect really badly, except I really need to be alone. So I have that, you know, terrible push-pull.
The old get away from me, I love you.
Yes, get away from me, I love you. So I'm desperate to connect with people and to have people know me and to be known in some ways. But I also really value my solitary time because I think that's what's creative.
Sure.
I think, you know, that is the dual side of creativity is that you have to know yourself in order to figure out what you have to say. And it's just not something anyone else can be inside that experience. You know, when I'm lying in Prospect Park in a pool of fake blood at 3 a.m. and somebody's going like, can you move a little more to the right, please? Or, you know, somebody's putting a fake gun in my hand or pretending to smack me across the face. I just can't explain that to other people.
Sure.
I really can't. It's just, it's an impossible emotional experience to explain to someone that I am inside my body and outside my body at the same time, that I can say like, what you mean like 3 inches to the right or 4 inches to the right? Like I can do that and also be inside the moment. And in order to do that, I have to be completely and totally alone, except I'm surrounded by 175
sure.
people and potentially those gamma rays or whatever a camera is will show every single pore of my face to millions of people that feel changed and touched by the experience, as they should, because it's intimate. So it's just a weird dichotomy.
It really is weird. It really, because that is a lot of clutter in the immediate, where it's like, okay, I'm going to drown out all of the, you know, I'm going to drown out the boom guy who has been up for 29 hours. He looks tired. He's staring off. He's got this mic, you know, and just being able to funnel all that out.
Yeah. And it's kind of like playing in a symphony orchestra, you know, where you all have your instrument and you're all playing your own particular instrument and you're all playing together. You're playing one piece of text, and you're bringing your language to that. And you're inside the experience, but you're outside going like, that guy's off time. You know, you should have brought that in on an eighth note instead of a quarter note. Or you have to be able to be inside the experience and outside the experience at the same time. It's kind of like a athlete magical feat.
Sure.
And we're all working together on a movie set, you know, with the technicians, with the DP, with the, you know, sound guys, with visual effects. I mean, we're all in it together. And when we're sewing all these seams, and then we get to the end part of the process, and then we erase all the seams, and we go, here it is. And hopefully an audience experiences it the way they meet a person. Yeah. They meet a whole person that's got legs and arms and feet and teeth and all those things. They're not paying attention to the seams that it took to create the Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, they're really experiencing like meeting somebody for the first time. But so much thought and imagination and technique and weird little technical things went into creating that monster.
Did you ever think about just quitting everything? I mean, because I understand when you're a kid and you get used to the junkets and everything, but then you're a kid. You're just a kid. But then you're an adult, and then after, you know, The Accused kind of made you like really part of pop culture, like really, really part of pop culture. And now you're an adult, and people start prying into your personal life, and they're asking about relationships, and they want to know about your romantic life. And you're like, you know, that hasn't anything to do with anything. Like, was there any point where you go, maybe I don't want to do this anymore because I just don't want to have to – I don't want to ever have to be public about anything because I'm me and I'm personal.
Well, I think you burn out on a lot of it. I mean, you also burn out on, you know, being on location for – if you do two movies back to back, if you do two movies a year – and let's just say each one of those is 4 months on location, and then you have 2 weeks of prep on each one of those, and then you have looping and dubbing, and then you have the junkets. So that's a month and a half of on a tour. And then there's the photo shoots. So that's – you know, if you put that together, that's your whole life.
Yeah.
So, you know, you burn out. If you don't burn out, there's something wrong with you. So I burn out periodically. I burn out over and over again, and I, you know, snap my foot and say, I'm never doing this again. But then I love making movies. You know, I love movies. It's why I didn't end up going to grad school and why I didn't become a professor, because I just really love movies. I love movies so much that I could punch someone in the face when when it's like they messed it up. Or I love them in a way that's really passionate. And I'm not sure – I really like books. And I do love books, but I don't think I love thinking.
Yeah.
The way that I love films.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just think you've done a really good job at being able to kind of separate and go, nope, this is the work and it's about the work and let's just keep it focused on the work. And I feel like to a degree, I feel like the media has kind of respected that. Yeah. I think they kind of just – you somehow condition them to go, you know, Jodie's a very private person, so let's not poke around too much and let's just focus on the work.
Yeah. There has been a lot of respect, and I'm really appreciative of that. I really do see that. But I also see that, it came by being trained. I mean, they were trained over and over again. They kept, you know – they kept getting smacked in the nose over and over again. It's like a dog that keeps getting smacked in the nose over and over again. You know, and I designed a different career. You know, I haven't had a pop star career. I didn't have a pop actor career, really. And I was clear that I didn't want that. And I chose specifically so that I wouldn't have that life because I knew it wouldn't suit me and I wouldn't survive it.
Yeah.
So nobody's, you know, running down the street after me trying to rip my clothes off. I don't, you know, I'm not Madonna or Tom Cruise or something.
I think there's something to really kind of embracing. I think if you can kind of convince people, like, yeah, I'm kind of boring, then they don't, you know what I mean? Like, they sort of leave you alone because they're like, well, there's not really a story here.
No, that's true. Yeah, George Clooney does this really interesting thing where he has like six of the same t-shirts and he wears the exact same t-shirt every single day. And he's like, at some point, they're really going to get tired of taking my picture in the exact same t-shirt because they're going to get the same shot over and over and over and over again.
He's almost upsettingly cool.
He is.
To the degree where you're like, how do you have the looks and but you're not a dick? Like, I've seen him in conversation. He just talks to people like a regular guy. He's not, you know, there's no air about like, I'm George Clooney. Like, he seems like a good guy.
He is a good guy. But he has his struggles too. I mean, if he didn't, he would be, you know, a cartoon character. I mean,
sure.
He's a real person and he, you know, I'm sure at some point he loses his temper in traffic or he gets drunk and throws up like everyone else. he's a real person. And he has – I think we all have what has allowed us to survive intact. And in his case, I would believe – and I don't want to be presumptuous because I'm not him. But I think that he really needs to have meaning in his life. And that's what he's found with social activism and politics and his ability to multitask. You know, George is everywhere. George is – you know, he's got a tequila company and he was in Syria last week and he's on the cover of this and I mean, I've never seen anybody do so many different things. And I'm just amazed. I mean, I'm really in awe of him because he's able to kind of commit and delegate and then commit and delegate so that he can just be a part of the whole world. And I feel like I'm like a weird little hamster that's just like treadmill, 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 treadmill. I can do one thing. I just do one thing and then I just keep getting for the pellet. And I could never accomplish as much as George accomplishes.
Well, I saw the movie. You guys, I have the iPad back to you. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's like there's an element of it that's real. It's claustrophobic, but just because I had no idea what the movie was about when I started watching it, because I like to be surprised. And it was really, really, really fun. And the guy who plays Kyle is fantastic. He's so, I mean, everyone in the movie is great, but that
Jack
kid,
O'Connell.
Oh, he's so great.
Yeah. At some point you'll see him being interviewed. He has like the thickest Northern England accent you've ever heard.
Yeah.
And he's quite the, you know, quite the British guy.
But he's like New York guy in the movie.
Yeah. He's great. He was just such a joy. I mean, so committed. I've never actually met or seen an actor that's as committed as he is. It's exhausting just to watch him. And he just gave everything to that part.
Are you already, now that this is done and you're just kind of wrapping the press on this, are you already on to something else or are you taking a break for a while?
No, I've got a month of press on this. Ahead of me.
Oh, fun.
And then I guess I'll move on to other things. But it's been a long process, so I'm really excited about not doing anything for a while.
Oh, I'm trying to figure out, you know, in most movies you can sort of figure out, like, what's the junket question going to be? Like, what's the one you're going to have to answer over and over and over?
What's it like working with Julia Roberts and George Clooney?
What is it? Did they reunite them in their movie? Was that fun?
You know, the truth is it is really fun. And they are great together. They have this weird, amazing chemistry. In fact, while we were shooting, they were virtually never in the same room. Only the first 2 minutes of the movie and in the last 2 minutes of the movie. And you can almost – you just feel them connecting just through the wires, you know.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful being on set with Julia Roberts. And she's fun and funny and does her homework and comes in prepared and just – everybody loves her. And it's strange, though. You go to the monitor and you look at her and then suddenly go, oh, that's Julia Roberts. And you forget. I forget who she is. And then I go look at her on a box and I'm like, oh, my God, that's Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts is in my movie? Oh, my gosh, I can't believe it.
I'm sure she does that every day. I'm sure every day she just like walks by the mirror and is like, oh,
Julia Roberts.
Oh, my God, oh, not wait,
that's
Julia
me.
Roberts.
That's me. I mean, that must be, you know, yeah. I mean, it's such a – the idea that this business, you know, can – really fuck with your brain a lot, but it kind of, you know, forces you to be so transient in a weird sort of way. Like, I'm always interested to find out how anyone has any semblance of any kind of normal anything, particularly if you're on that level. I just don't know.
Yeah. And the questions of celebrity are of interest to me. I mean, Money Monster, obviously, that all comes to play.
Absolutely.
He plays, a joke of a financial news host.
He's kind of like a Jim Cramer type of a guy.
He's like a Jim Cramer type, although he's a little smoother and a little more George.
Yeah.
But he's just unconscious and he's lost in his own life. He has this tremendous ego and yet he feels horrible about himself. And it's that weird combination of, you know, being sort of pumped up on, you know, the public steroids in some ways to how they think about you and how you see yourself in the mirror, and then realizing that you're just a, you know nothing and you're just a shell of a person. And he has to face that in this sort of spiritual crisis that happens during this hostage taking.
Who do you empathize with most in the movie? Do you have one character?
I think every character is me. That's how it works, where you're always saying, who would I be? And then you sort of shape the character. So there's a part of me, of course, that feels like George's character, Lee Gates, the celebrity talk show host in some ways, who's doesn't really understand who he is, doesn't know who he is anymore, has lost himself, and who just feels like a failure. And the guy who's just filled with rage because he did everything right. That's Kyle, that's played by Jack O'Connell. He did everything right. He did what he was supposed to do. He squirreled away money. He worked hard at his job. And he did what the guy told him to do. And he lost everything. And he's mad. I mean, I get that too. I mean, there's a part of me that feels like, you know, understands the rage of being like, but I did everything right. What do you mean you stole all my money?
Yeah.
That's
hard. I followed the list. What happened?
And then there's Julia Roberts' character, who is the incredibly strong woman who's the Jiminy Cricket. Because she is in his ear. She's the Jiminy Cricket to this guy who she loves, even though he's not self-knowledgeable. And she multitasks in order to produce his survival. She's better than the police. She's smarter than anyone in the movie.
Yeah.
And she's able to pull all of that off and still remain calm for him, you know. And I get that too. You know, I feel like all three of those characters. There's a bad guy too. And sometimes, you know, his point of view in the film is nobody was complaining when we were making you money.
Right.
You know, everybody was gobbling up as many stocks as they could and they were looking a blind eye and looking away. But the second we started losing money, then people start paying attention. But if you really want to embrace what capitalism is and you want to be competitive with China and Russia, you got to start looking for margins any way you can.
Yeah, because you as an audience member, you flip-flop. The reason I asked you who you're empathetic to, because it's like, oh, now I feel bad for Clooney. Oh, now I feel bad for the kid. Yeah. Now I feel bad for the woman who works for the guy. Mm-hmm. It's like you there's a lot of flip-flopping with who you – because everyone kind of presents a case for – why they sort of have it rough.
Right. I think that's all my movies. I think that's true of all my movies, where I'm always – and I do a lot of ensemble films, you know, where you can relate to every single one of the characters. Home for the Holidays is a good example where, you know, you're faced with a family and you have the one who stayed home and who, you know, does everything for the parents, which, of course, the parents don't appreciate because she's the one that stayed home. Who cares about her? And all the parents really care about is each other because – you know, they've been having this same dysfunctional relationship forever where he never talks to the children and doesn't answer the phone because he'd rather be working on his vacuum cleaner.
Right.
You know, there's all these bits of dysfunction all interlace in a tapestry. And I see everyone's side. I think that's what a director does.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I absolutely think people should go see Money Monster. It was not – I didn't know what to expect. The posters are very striking. The billboards are very striking. But I just didn't – you know, when I immediately kind of got like, oh, okay, I see what the movie is about. And it is very – it follows the story all the way through to the end.
Yeah. I mean, it is a fast-paced thriller and it's super, super fast-paced because it does reflect the pace of technology. And it's exciting, intense, and all those things. But I think the thing that people don't expect is that it's a really amazing character piece that's more like a play.
Yeah.
It's a play between three people in some ways, three people that are engaged in this weird dynamic. And even though the story plays out all across the globe on every screen in the world simultaneously. Some of it is really just about the tiny details of shame that these characters carry with each other.
Yeah, and also everyone kind of has a discovery of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Everyone kind of has to have that moment. And there, you know, Kyle has it. There's a particular moment in the movie where he gets called out by someone and he kind of has that like, oh, shit. You know, like everyone kind of has that moment of they think they're doing the right thing and then they realize, oh, wait, I haven't really been paying attention.
Yeah. I mean, aside from the fact that it really is a genre movie and it does clip along and it's about exciting things. For me, the movie's really about failure and about men, specifically men's relationship to failure and self-hatred and the failure especially that they feel reflected in the eyes of these strong women.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it is – you know, failure is a little tied to our ego sometimes, a lot of the time. But it is kind of – I think it is good to – do you think – but it doesn't mean everything. Failure doesn't mean everything. I feel like we take it hard sometimes like, oh, everything's fucking ruined and I can't remember. But it doesn't really mean everything, or do you think it does?
No, I don't think it does. But I think we live in fear of it. I think we don't know who we are unless we're winning. And that's certainly a part of modern culture. It's certainly a part of the financial world. You know, you know, what is the financial world? The financial world is telling you you are valuable because you own such and such stock.
Sure.
Most of it's on paper. You know, you're not going to eat more turkey because you just have 20,000 more shares of Apple computers. I mean, a lot of it is really just about the idea of value. It's not really value in itself. And, you know, more money, more value, more stocks, that must mean I'm better. Does that mean I'm better? And if I lose at this poker game, does that mean that I'm worse? It's a weird – it's a value machine that's off kilter.
As we're wrapping up, where do you place value? Where do you think we should place value?
I'm all for experiences. I feel like once you hit 40, nobody should give you any presents that aren't experiences. They should give you like food. They should give you, you know, a day in the pool. They should give you sand in your toes or something. You know, you should have an experience because what do you want with all that crap?
Yeah.
You're just going to have to sell it at a garage sale.
You know, ironically, I'm looking behind you at a wall of crap. I know. But to be fair, that is an original Muppet Show lunchbox.
Yes.
So you probably meant everything but like that, right?
No. I mean, you know, they're totems, but they're totems of memory.
Sure.
I mean, they're totems of memory. That's what art is too.
Yeah.
I mean, you hold something in your hand and you're like, when I was five, my dad gave this to me. Or remember that cool concert that I was at where we were all had our arms linked around each other and we fell all over each other. I mean, you want to hold on to these things so you can recreate those memories.
Sure.
And you know, that's why people buy Renaissance paintings, because, you know, Da Vinci painted it, and when he painted it, he used this oil. It's the story behind it, the story that you can retell and say, see this painting? This is what Leonardo was doing, and that's why I bought this painting. And the real value is really the experience.
Well, I honestly can't thank you enough for coming in. And I was a little nervous at first. I'm like, well, I've never seen Jodie Foster talk for longer than a few minutes. So I don't know if she's going to.
It was funny. I was like, when you walked in, I was like, wait, did it start? I guess it started. Oops. Yeah, I guess it started.
Well, you know, I never want people to sort of, especially if you're, because this isn't really. I'm not a journalist, and these are really just like coffee chats. Like if I met you and like, let's go to coffee and just talk. And so I feel like if you go, welcome to the show, that makes people immediately go, this is an official thing and my defenses are up and I'm not, so I feel like it's better just to have an experience. Like let's just talk like people. Let's be human and talk like people and not have it be, you know, a clipboard. And then what, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. And I don't think. Well, I do a lot of interviews, right? Because you do junk. I mean, it's part of my job is I do a lot of interviews. And I think that we've kind of lost the dialogue thing. And people don't know how to have a dialogue anymore. They don't know how to go back and forth.
Well, because everything is all about how many – we need to get as many people to see this thing in a moment as possible. So how do we do that? We do that with clipping and sound bites and fear-mongering and tabloid exploitation and, you know, creating false stories to get attention.
Yeah, sound bites. Sound bites are interesting because, I can sometimes because I just think I'll think of really bad analogies. And then if I say them, then somebody will put them in print and then it haunts me for the rest of my life. So I've learned to try to calm down on saying I once said something like, if I see a dead bird on the street, I don't know. I don't know about you. I just want to kick it aside. I don't know.
Jodie Foster hates birds.
I don't want to hug it. I don't want to like go down and go like, how are you feeling? I just want to kick it aside. And I think that's up there with the stupidest thing that I've ever said in my entire life. And there is no way that I will ever be able to go on an IMDb page, on any page of my life, and not see, whenever I see a dead bird, I just want to kick it. I mean, literally, I must see that. If I ever plugged into the internet, that is all I would see. It's the dumbest thing anyone could see. Obviously, I was trying to make a point.
Yes.
But in this...
That all birds should be killed. Did I miss that?
Technology age.
Oh, okay. I think I missed the point on that.
It's definitely... The point was not had.
Well, no wonder you would be... You kind of have to be introverted and protective because everything you say gets put under a microscope. But
yeah.
I think we understand that that was just an analogy.
It was just an analogy.
On behalf of the world and the internet, I absolve you of your bird comment. You may fly and be free, unlike that bird who is dead. But thank you so much for being here.
It was an absolute joy.
And, you know, maybe I don't know if we'll ever get to meet again, but I'll just assume that we're pals, and I'll send you a poem for Christmas. I'll send you a non-gift for Christmas.
I think once you've done one of these, I don't think you'll ever want to have me back.
Are you kidding?
Because I think that will be it. It'll be just like, that's enough already. This was
no. No. I feel like, I mean, I've already dominated an hour and a half of your time, and so, but honestly... If you have another thing, if you want to, you absolutely can come back and promote. Or if you said, you know, that Chris Hardwick's guy, he's not such a bad egg. I think I'm going to have him over for coffee for 15 minutes. And I'm going to kick him out. I would love to talk because I am fascinated by a lot of the same things that are of interest to you, just in terms of celebrity and culture and where are we going. And that's a lot of what the undertone of this whole podcast experience and 800 episodes is. What's human about what we're doing and how do you find humanity in a relatively cold and inhuman way that we communicate now, which is via devices and interfacing with machines. And so, anytime.
Yeah, and I don't trust it. I'm not good with machines. I mean, I do them, but I'm never going to be the guy you go, oh, we're doing the next installation of Star Wars. Let's call Jody to direct it. I mean, that's not me. The only thing that I trust is my human connection.
Sure.
It's like, so I know for a fact that if I'm operating on a different level, that I will fail miserably. So I don't make movies about Martians unless they're a Martian family that are having crises. I know better, I think, because I know what I trust.
And then also maybe at some point you might say, Chris, I'm going to teach you how to chop wood.
Yeah.
Because I know that you don't, and I know that I would not survive in an apocalypse. So
anytime.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Jodie Foster.
My pleasure.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Wow. That was fantastic.
Oh,
wow.
Thank you.
That just started. I was like, wait, are we started? Did we start?
Yeah, it's cool. Good for you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.